Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the Washington Post has reported that Trump's communications with foreign leader are part of whistleblower complaint that spurred standoff between spy chief and Congress, former officials say. The whistleblower complaint that has triggered a tense showdown between the U.S. intelligence community and Congress involves President Trump's communications with a foreign leader, according to two former U.S. officials familiar with the matter. Trump's interaction with the foreign leader included a quote-unquote promise that was regarded as so troubling that it prompted an official in the U.S. intelligence community to file a formal whistleblower complaint with the Inspector General for the intelligence community, said the former officials, speaking on the condition of anonymity because they're not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. How big of a problem is this, and on how many levels is this a problem? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He's a former CIA counterterrorism officer and a former senior investigator with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He became the sixth whistleblower indicted by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act, a law designed to punish spies. He served 23 months in prison as a result of his attempts to oppose the Bush administration's torture program. He's also the co-host of Loud and Clear, heard here every day on Radio Sputnik. John Kiriakou, as always, John, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So, last night I'm flipping channels and I hear Rachel Maddow say, breaking news, the Washington Post reports a whistleblower has filed a complaint that the president was on the phone with an unknown foreign leader and he made an unknown promise. And I said to my wife, okay, Rachel, call me when you've got some details, yeah. But I don't know how much news that is. But there really must be some meat on this bone. Talk to me.
Well, there must be. And the reason I say that, the reason I've concluded that is we all know now after 8 years of Barack Obama's war on whistleblowers that whistleblowers, especially national security whistleblowers, have literally nothing to gain and everything to lose by making a disclosure. Whoever this whistleblower is, he or she decided that for the sake of the country, that disclosure needed to be made. So we've also seen exactly why the process doesn't work. The process itself, Wilmer, is corrupted. You know, they teach us at the CIA and everywhere else in the intelligence community that if you witness evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety, that the first thing you do is you go through your chain of command, okay? When I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program, I did not go through my chain of command because my chain of command created the torture program. So that made no sense. Ed Snowden didn't go through his chain of command because his chain of command was responsible for warrantless wiretapping and mass surveillance. Tom Drake did go through his chain of command at NSA exactly as he was supposed to. He went to the Inspector General, to the General Counsel, to the DOD Inspector General, and to the House Oversight Committee. And he was charged with 9 felonies, including 7 counts of espionage.
Let me jump in and ask you this. Is the going through the chain of command the established process to protect the agency or to protect the country? And what I mean by protect the country, you swore an oath to protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Yep.
So is it to see to it that your issue is properly vetted so that the public can be protected, or is it designed to protect the
That's a great question. That's the $64,000 question, and the answer is actually easy. The answer is that it's meant to protect the agency, right, or the department, or whatever the bureaucracy happens to be where you're making the disclosure. Well, this whistleblower, who has nothing to gain personally by blowing the whistle, went through the chain of command. We know from the Washington Post that the whistleblower went to the Inspector General. The Inspector General deemed the disclosure to be true and important enough that it demanded immediate action. And so the Inspector General,
Michael Atkinson,
went to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI.
Joseph McGuire,
who's a Trump appointee. Now, he
an acting director.
And only acting director. We do not yet have a permanent director of national intelligence. Now, when the disclosure was made, it was supposed to be investigated by ODNI and then referred to Congress. Okay? That wasn't done. They just killed it. They sat on it. They covered it up. They just killed it and hoped it would go away.
So help me out now, because as I understand, the law is very clear here. There's
Indeed.
Very little, if any, ambiguity about once this once the Inspector General has gone through their process and their investigation and they found that this matter was of urgent concern, quote unquote,
yes.
urgent concern, it's supposed to go to Congress.
Yes.
When it doesn't go to Congress, what are the options that Congress has? Contempt of Congress? Who's supposed to get arrested? Who's supposed
yeah.
to be pulled out of their house well, in the middle of the night in handcuffs? What's supposed to happen?
Let me preface it by saying that's never happened.
Right.
Right? It's supposed to happen, but what you're saying is exactly the way it's supposed to play out. There should be a citation of contempt of Congress. It's a misdemeanor. But it ought to be enough. It's supposed to be enough to force action on the part of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The thing is then how does Congress know that ODNI is sitting on a whistleblower complaint? The whistleblower had to go out of the chain of command and had to go to Capitol Hill, just like Tom Drake did in 2007, and say, listen, I made a whistleblower disclosure. It's a protected whistleblower disclosure. It's within the confines of the whistleblower protection law, and it's being covered up. Now, apparently, that's what he did. He went to Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Adam Schiff then went to the press. Now, apparently, he tried to work this through channels himself, and he wrote a letter to the DNI saying, hey, we heard from this whistleblower. What's going on over there? And he was ignored. And so now he's issued a subpoena to ODNI, and then the acting DNI came out and said, okay, we'll respond to the subpoena.
Why not issue the article of contempt? Because this, to me, takes me right back to yesterday with Jerry Nadler in the House Judiciary Committee and Corey Lewandowski. Why not hold him in contempt? Use the power of the law.
Because the problem is the Justice Department won't prosecute the case. They already said that in the aftermath of the Mueller hearings.
But put the pressure, then to me, you're using public pressure.
Yeah.
We have legally filed this.
Yes. Contempt order.
Contempt order. Now the ball's in your court. Explain to the public why you're not doing your job.
I would. And I would go one further. I would say, as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, if I don't get satisfaction, if you don't observe the tenets of the law, if you don't send this whistleblower information to Capitol Hill in formal channels like you're supposed to, I'm going to go to the media and I'm going to tell them everything without revealing sources and methods, of course. But if this whistleblower is alleging that the president has committed a crime by making an illegal promise to a foreign leader, I think the American people have the right to know.
Well, that takes me to what was going to be probably two questions from now, which is today Atkinson appeared before the House Intelligence Committee in a classified session
Right. Closed.
That session should have been open. And to your point, we're going to talk about everything under the sun except sources and methods and confidential material. We want the public. We want to shine the light of purity
yes.
on this thing to get rid of all the infection.
And, you know, most Americans don't know, actually, Wilmer, that it is illegal to classify a crime. You can't classify something if it's a criminal act, and you can't classify something just to save embarrassment,
okay.
save an agency or department from being embarrassed. That's illegal. It's a felony, actually.
Okay.
It is also a felony, although it has never, ever been prosecuted, to overclassify something. If something ought to be unclassified or confidential, which is the lowest level of classification, and it's classified like almost everything is at the secret level or the top secret level, that is a felony. And nobody has ever bothered to either prosecute it or even to try to get classifying organizations, or I should say organizations who have classification authority, to ramp down their classification. So we don't even know if this information has been legitimately classified. I think you're right. I think that session, or at least that part of that session, ought to have been held in open hearing, and the American people have a right to know.
So let's get back to the unknown promise made by the president to the unknown foreign leader. Now, what I've been hearing, they talk about two people. They talk about Kim Jong-un, and they talk about Vladimir Putin. Now, those apparently aren't the only two world leaders that the president spoke to during the time frame in which this promise was supposed to have been made. But those are the two names that they throw out at us constantly. Are they, do you think they're trying to, that the media is trying to inflate the significance of this? Do you think that it was actually one of those two leaders? What do you think?
Well, as you said before we started taping this, it was breathless breaking news last night that the president talked to somebody and made some kind of promise. Oh my God, right? Top story.
OMG.
So we don't really know. You know, the president takes a lot of guff too, and in my view, rightly, for just blurting out classified information. That's bad form, mm-hmm. but it's not illegal because he's the president.
He can do it.
And he can do it. He has the right to declassify anything he wants. Well.
Wait a minute. Let me ask you something quickly mm-hmm. on that.
Sure.
Is there a process that he has to go through to declassify before he divulges, or can he just say what he wants to say when he wants to say it and go, oh, well, I just declassified
it? He's the only person who can just blurt it out, okay. and that makes okay. it declassified. Okay. Everybody else has to go through a very okay. formal and tedious process
Thank you.
To have it reviewed at level after level after level okay. and then finally be declassified. And then there's mandatory declassification after 30 or 35 years, and then there are exemptions.
A la the Kennedy situation.
Exactly, exactly. The Kennedy documents, for example.
But to your point, there's got to be some meat on this bone based upon the process that the unknown—
Well, there's one thing that mystifies me.
Okay.
My immediate response to that question is, yes, there has to be meat on the bone. But then it leads me to think something else. Now— The notion that CIA, NSA, or some other three-letter agency intercepted a presidential call, that's just so beyond the pale, I can't even imagine that it happened. I think the chances are 99% that it happened this way. Because we ask, how would this whistleblower have known about a presidential call to a foreign leader?
Well, the way that they're reporting it now, they got people sitting in the basement listening to these calls all day, every day.
I'll make a correction to that. They're sitting right there in the Oval Office while the president's okay. on the okay. on the. What happens normally when the president has a call with a foreign leader is that there are three other people on extensions in the Oval Office. It's always the National Security Advisor. It's almost always the White House Chief of Staff, and then the appropriate National Security Council analyst for
the region or the issue.
Exactly, exactly. And if it's not that person, it's a senior CIA analyst who's the substantive expert on whatever issue is being discussed. They don't speak on the call. They're just there to listen, and then the lowest ranking person is there to take notes. My guess is the whistleblower is that lowest ranking person, whether it's a National Security Council officer or a CIA officer. I don't think this was an intercepted call. I think the whistleblower was a note taker. The whistleblower was appalled by what he heard, and the whistleblower went back to his headquarters and reported it. But why didn't the National Security Advisor report it? And why didn't the Chief of Staff report it? Or why didn't they go back to the president and say, hey, you can't do that. You can't make promises.
The National Security Advisor
would have been John Bolton.
Appointed by the president.
Correct.
The chief of staff.
Appointed by the president.
The lowest ranking intelligence officer
is. A career civil servant.
There we go. Mm-hmm. There we go.
So and again, I'm going to repeat myself what I said when we first started talking. This whistleblower is not stupid and blind. He or she has seen what's happened to the last 10 national security whistleblowers, right? Most of us have ended up going to prison. And so he has nothing to gain and everything to lose, and still believed that this was so important that he had to make the disclosure.
As I was preparing for this in putting together my introduction of you, and I've done this a number of times, but this story in your introduction, you became the sixth whistleblower indicted by the Obama administration under the espionage.
Yes.
The perception of President Obama is he's the warm and fuzzy guy. He's the guy that everybody wanted because he was going to set us free and he was going to take America. But as Amiri Baraka has said, the late Amiri Baraka said to me a number of times, he's a functionary of the United States government. He's the president of the United States. And all of that perception is just perception.
Yes.
Did you, when you became a whistleblower, were you surprised by the reaction and the fact that you were prosecuted and the fact that you wound up spending 23 months in prison? Did you have some faith in the Obama administration?
Oh, boy, did I. Did I?
So you were naive.
I was. I was shocked to the point of
speechlessness. So my question isn't stupid.
I made my revelations during the Bush administration, and I was investigated by the FBI for a year from December of 2007 to December of 2008. And the Bush Justice Department closed the case, said I had not committed a crime, and sent my attorneys a declination letter declining to prosecute me. 4 weeks later, when Barack Obama was inaugurated, John Brennan, who was the number two at the National Security Council at the time, went on to be the CIA director, asked the Justice Department under Eric Holder to secretly reopen the case against me. And I was prosecuted by the Obama administration, not by the Bush people. You know, I believed in the whole hope and change thing. I volunteered on the campaign. I took my kids to the inauguration. And then the whole weight of the U.S. government fell on my head.
You stood outside
in the
cold with your
kids? We did. Yes, we did.
Man.
We did. It was a historic day.
Yes, it was historically cold.
Yeah, it was historically cold as well. Yes, yes. But it was Barack Obama who went after whistleblowers, not George W. Bush.
That, and again, that didn't really register with me until this story that we're talking about now. And then as I was preparing your introduction, I said, wow, this really contradicts the image and the perception of hope and change and si se puede, yes, we can,
right,
and all of that
right
kind of stuff. No, this was business as usual.
It was.
If not worse.
You know, it's funny. People forget, at least as far as intelligence and national security went, Barack Obama surrounded himself with Bush people, right? All of those senior CIA people came of age under—
And his finance people.
Under George W. Bush and his finance and treasury people. Absolutely.
So as we were thinking that this was going to be the ultra-liberal administration, it was based in much more conservatism than most people really paid attention to or understood.
Well, in the book Double Down by Mark Halperin and John Heilemann, they have two quotes there from President Obama that were shocking to me then when I read the book in 2013, just as shocking as it is now, where Obama said two things. One, very matter-of-factly, he said, I never said I was a liberal.
Which is true.
Which is true.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing he said was talking about the drone program. I never had any idea that I would be so good at killing people, which was also true. You know, I like to point out that in George W. Bush's final month as president, he killed two people with the use of a drone. And in Barack Obama's last month as president, he killed 424 people with drones.
And I remember Eric Holder saying, the American president can kill any American
anywhere
in the world,
right,
without judicial review.
And Senator Rand Paul in that hearing said, are you saying that the president can kill an American citizen in the United States without judicial process, due process? And he said, yes.
And my having gone to law school, I asked myself, what constitution did Eric Holder not read?
Seriously, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's stunning.
So in the coming days, particularly now that this hearing has taken place, I would expect that more information will be forthcoming.
I think you're right.
Whether Adam Schiff wants it released or not. And do you have any ideas at the end of the day, as we wrap this up, do you have any ideas at the end of the day what we're going to find out?
You know, I think we're probably, I think you're probably right. It's going to be either Putin or Kim Jong-un. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be just some stupid thing that Donald Trump threw out there just to, as a feel good, as a sop. He probably didn't intend to do anything about it anyway. And he's going to get a slap on the wrist by the media. And then we're going
to
move on.
Is it too simplistic to say that this is much ado about nothing, or that it is serious, but in today's climate?
Serious, but.
Okay.
You know, so many crazy things have become normal
in the last three years.
Right. Yeah. I think that people are exhausted. I think that there's Trump fatigue. And where under any other president, this might be a national crisis, I think it's probably a one-week story.
I have posited a number of times, the most surprised person in the country that Donald Trump became president was Donald Trump.
Without a doubt.
And that this has, for him, really been more of a financial business venture than a presidency based upon interest in truly advancing the country. And that he's really trying to still build that Trump Tower in somewhere in Russia, and that he wants to build a Trump Tower somewhere in North Korea, because he has been told that once that option opens, a flood of investment is going to go into the country, and he wants to be on the forefront of the investment.
I think that that's a part of his soul, and he just can't change.
So I'm not crazy for thinking that.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Wow. John Kiriakou, as always, man, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And I know you really gave us time today. As always, thank you for your analysis. Appreciate your time and your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. HHS official says separated migrant kids suffer extraordinary trauma. Commander Jonathan White, a career public health official at the Department of Health and Human Services, told Congress yesterday that children separated from their families face, quote, extraordinary, severe, end quote, trauma, leading to likely lifelong harm of both a mental and physical nature. Children were taken away from their families as part of the Trump administration's attempt to discourage crossings at the border. The practice instead backfired, with the U.S. government thrust into the role of holding on to children who've been taken from their families. How do we solve this problem for these children and their families? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a nationally known immigrant rights activist, co-founder of the Latinx organization Mejente, and community organizer with the Northwest Detention Center Resistance, Maru Mora Villapando. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you again for the invitation.
Thank you so much for joining us. So give us some insight in terms of what you understand about this hearing and what Commander Jonathan White told Congress yesterday.
Well, I think it's, sometimes it takes these big names and titles to finally make valid what is being a very well-known thing in regards to children being traumatized by this current administration. I mean, you don't have to be an expert to know that children in general are a vulnerable population. We need to treat them with so much special care. You don't have to be even a parent to know that you should treat children with care, with love, and dignity as human beings that they are. So having him going to Congress and give this very professional opinion makes it possible for us to actually start moving ahead and forward to end this horrible practice that obviously this white supremacist xenophobic regime has no shame in doing, and they don't seem to actually want it to stop And it will require more from Congress to actually having them stop this practice of separating the children from their parents and putting them in cages as they've done with adults in the past.
White testified to a subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee at a briefing titled Oversight Hearing Mental Health Needs of Children in HHS Custody. The trauma separated children have sustained are at both extraordinarily severe and they are currently ongoing. And we are part of that traumatization in the United States government, White said. Explain a little bit about how things have changed. Families have been coming across the border with children for quite a while. So explain why now there is this increasing problem with the traumatic impact that this whole circumstance or is having on children. What's different now than, say, 5 years ago?
Well, as a matter of fact, under Obama's administration, the family detention centers, quote unquote, began. So in the past, children wouldn't be placed in first to be separated from their parents and second to be placed in detention. It did happen a while ago. Let's remember that one of the legal arguments that lawyers have made against the detention of children is the, if I remember correctly, is the Flores settlement from 1997 that precisely said that children shouldn't be kept in detention for more than 20 days. So it has happened, but not at this level. It didn't happen before Obama. When Obama came into office, they created the family detention centers, like I mentioned. But what has happened now under this administration is the creation of this quote-unquote zero tolerance policy, which was to criminalize parents to excuse the separation of their children. And so what the administration did last year is to accuse parents with this federal charge, which is called 1325 in the federal code, which accuses people, adults, from coming into the country without a permit, without the permission of the authorities, crossing the border, making it a felony, and then putting them in federal custody. And with that, they argue, look, they are criminals. They have a federal charge. We cannot rely on them on taking care of their children. So that was their excuse to separate children in the first place. But then not only that, because remember, there's an office that takes care of our refugees and it takes care of children. Because there's been also minors that have crossed the border for decades. You know, a lot of people now, adults, will tell you that they arrived here at 15, 14 years old, some even 13 years old, by themselves. So this is a common thing in migration where minors do travel by themselves, go through different countries, and in the United States example, it has happened so much that there's already that system that takes care of minors. And the difference now is these minors are not really taken care of. They're actually criminalized as well by the fact that they've been put in deportation proceedings. Which it has happened before, they are put in deportation proceedings, but they were given lawyers because they were minors. So the difference is not only they put in cages like they've been doing with adults for all these decades, but now they're also trying to worsen the conditions, abuse them during detention, and taking away the possibility of a legal representation and getting away with the Flores settlement to keep them in detention as long as they want instead of the 20 days that they were supposed to. Not exceed.
You mentioned Section 1325 in Title 8 of the U.S. Code. I believe that was the basis of the big argument that former Secretary of HHS Julian Castro and presidential candidate had with Beto O'Rourke, former congressman and Democratic presidential candidate. Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio, he focused during the debate on 1325. That's the provision that makes it a misdemeanor to illegally enter the country. Castro challenged the candidates to repeal that provision so that coming into the country without authorization would be a civil offense rather than a crime. Is that correct?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, administration, they really didn't use that federal code against people crossing the border. The one that is being used a lot is 1326, which is for people that re-entry after deportation. So we totally support Castro's call for getting rid of 1325 and not criminalizing people as they cross the border. But also it would be great to hear candidates going beyond and repealing 1326 because a lot of the parents that get deported and their children are here, they're going to come back. They're not going to abandon their children. That's their right to be with their children, but it's also their obligation. So we are criminalizing people that want to do the right thing for their families. And that is what is so appalling about this administration when they argue against the fact of criminalizing their parents, separating their children, and the level of trauma that they're willing to do against this generation of children that are coming to the country, being forced in the first place. Remember that the people that are coming to our southern border are really being forced from leaving their countries in the first place.
And White also went on to say the best available evidence we have on trauma and toxic stress suggests that the long-term effects of the process would be both severe and very difficult to manage with even high levels of clinical care. So what are some of the proposals that you're putting forth so that we can lessen this trauma and toxic stress? Are you looking to have the government revert back to the practices of the Obama administration, or are you looking for even more than that?
Oh, we want to end detention and deportation altogether. Deportation is violent. Just think about it. It's being created under the pretense that people are bad people. Sometimes they're not even people, right? That's why they excuse the treatment that we receive in detention centers, because they don't see us even as human beings. But really, it's violence against communities of color. The vast majority of people detained throughout the nation, the 55,000 that we have now as a maximum that we had ever had in detention, are people of color. People of color from really poor countries. There's no way to end trauma, but only ending with detention and ending with deportation. For us, the part of the healing of all of those that have been in detention, regardless of their age, is reparations. It doesn't matter if you're an adult. I can tell you everybody that we have met that have been in detention have some sort of trauma, some sort of mental health issue. So I think that as we have we continue working so hard to end detention and deportation and abolishing immigration customs enforcement altogether, we are thinking also on how to heal our communities. You know, I would say even think of the example of parents that are getting a divorce. How many of our children that are going through divorce need therapy? And that therapy includes the parents, because we know that when a child is separated from a parent, it does create some sort of trauma. Now, if you add to that the level of violence that our families, our children are going through under this administration and under the ICE and CBP custody, it's logical to require that they should, and some of those should be providing mental health therapy, but also ensuring that these families have what they require in regards to, you know, not even having to worry about, am I going to be able to find a job? Am I going to be able to, you know, have my child in a school, and that my child will do well in a school? Like, you know, just think of the basics of what the social fabric is. We all should take care of each other. We all should make sure that our children are doing well, that they're fed, that they're housed, that they can go to school and be the best they can be. And that should be applied to everybody, but especially those that have been intentionally traumatized by this administration.
Now, the administration says that putting families in these facilities is necessary because they've broken the law coming across the border. And if you just catch and release, that they will not return back in time for their immigration asylum hearings, that they will just blend in to the country, never to be heard from again.
You know, something that is funny with our argument is that we can prove with facts and statistics that the vast majority of people that are on the deportation proceedings, they do come back to their hearings because we want to stay in the country. We didn't come to hide within the country. That doesn't make sense. You know, when we come to the country, we want to stay in the country. We want to be part of the community. So that idea that people are going to flee is just ridiculous. Second, let's remember that we have a crisis because it was manufactured, not only by this administration, but previous administrations. There's been constant erosion of the very few possibilities to legalize our status within the immigration law for decades. So in order to actually make sure that we can legalize our status, the doors should be open again. Instead of shutting down literally the doors as the U.S. has done in collaboration with Mexico, and now they're expanding to Guatemala and El Salvador, asking these countries to also stop migration, to actually detain them. Mexico is considering now building private detention centers as we have here in the U.S. They have deported people from Honduras in flights directly from the southern border with Guatemala. So everything that is wrong with the migration system here in the U.S., they have exported now to places like Mexico, and they want to expand that. So they are not making it any easier for us to actually gain a status. It's really funny that the country, you know, not the country, but the government complains about us not having a status or having a piece of paper. It's up to them whether we have the paper or not. It's not up to us.
We've heard for years, sensible immigration reform, sensible immigration reform. When you hear that, what does that mean to you? And what would be two things, for example, that could be implemented, or two pieces of legislation or two policies that could be put in place and implemented that, in your mind, would be sensible immigration reform?
Well, to me, when I heard sensible immigration reform, it tells me that this is Congress coming with something that, you know, lobbyists from big companies have requested. I am very worried every time I hear those words, or common sense immigration reform. All of that to me shows that they're utilizing against the criminalization against our people and calling for more militarization and more profiting of our presence in the U.S. To me, there will be two critical things that could happen right now. One is undoing 1326 and 1325 from the federal penal code against people that are attempting to come back or attempting to ask for asylum in the U.S. or crossing the border to get some sort of status. And the other one is getting rid of detention altogether, both private and non-private, run by ICE or run by county jails. Once we get rid of the detention system, then that goes away with profit motives. And remember, the reason why most people get criminalized in the immigration system is because there's money there. We become dollars to the detention system and the deportation system. So not only we're dollars as cheap disposable labor in the United States, but we also become dollars in the private and regular detention system. So those two pieces in itself could actually change completely how we see our presence as immigrants in the U.S. and also to think about a country that doesn't have to cage people anymore.
What about changing American foreign policy towards countries such as Honduras, such as El Salvador, such as Guatemala, because people are leaving for valid reasons, whether it's economic, whether it's climate, whether it is violence. There are a number of American foreign policy issues towards these countries that are motivating, forcing people to flee. They're not leaving for vacation. They're fleeing because of horrific, unhuman-like living conditions in their countries.
Definitely. The role of the United States in international politics has been huge in generating this massive migration. You know, it's not new. I'm one of the many that in the 90s had to flee because of NAFTA. Then, you know, the free trade agreement created a very hard economical condition for us. We couldn't compete with businesses coming from the U.S. or Canada. But obviously, nowadays, yes, there's not only economic reasons, but also political reasons. Just remember, during the Obama administration, the then Secretary Clinton supporting the coup in Honduras in 2009. That today has shown horrible consequences. The current president and his brother have been accused of corruption. We see also in Mexico right now the threat of raising the tariffs against Mexico if they didn't shut down the border and stop every migrant from coming in. So there's both the active role from the U.S. in supporting dictators in our countries. Another one is the impose of economic sanctions, or in this case, the threat of some sort of economic sanctions against governments that don't want to cooperate with the U.S. And of course, the climate change that we're facing that is so much generated from the U.S. in itself and their policies. So until the U.S. really realizes how much their role has impacted not only our continent, but really the world in creating this massive immigration push, then we definitely have to be ready for more people coming in.
If you wouldn't mind, to take just a couple of minutes and explain how NAFTA in the 90s impacted you and your family directly. What were you all doing? Where were you? And how did NAFTA impact you all personally?
Well, I was in Mexico City. I'm from Mexico City. And we noticed how these American products and companies started moving in. I was part of a very small business, and there was no way we could have survived and compete with products from the U.S. A lot of the few companies in Mexico that were national, they rather buy products or send manufacturing things to other places versus paying their own employees or small businesses in Mexico, because they actually...
But wait a minute. We were told that NAFTA was going to create jobs in Mexico and that NAFTA was going to improve the economy in Mexico because American corporations were coming to Mexico to manufacture. So that was supposed to create opportunity in Mexico. That's what we were told.
Yeah, that's what we were told as well. The very few jobs that were open, and maybe there were more jobs at some point after I left, they were really miserable, low-quality, low-paid jobs. A good example of the horrible manufacturing industry that moved into Mexico is the manufacturing that grew along the border. These companies intentionally set shops at the border because they knew there were a lot of people trying to migrate to the U.S. that couldn't make it. So they would settle for whatever job they could find. And nowadays, after so many years, we see the impact of not only low-quality jobs, but really the danger that they created, the hostile environment that these companies created, because they were not only operating without, they didn't have to pay taxes, they didn't have to follow any labor laws, but also we saw the burn of feminicides, women being killed. Till today, we have thousands and thousands of women being killed, dismembered, horribly, horribly killed, and nobody knows anything. And there's such an impunity. And they happen to be, most of them, workers of these manufacturing companies. So that is really what this NAFTA did for Mexico. Was one, it really undo our economy. Small businesses went down. The few jobs that were offered, terrible, low-quality jobs. And at the end of the day, that impacts the rest of the community, and then was the surge of the organized crime responding to the lack of jobs.
Maru Mara Villapando, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work, and thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you, and yes, see you at the next.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, a judge just blocked South Dakota's riot-boosting law, but anti-protest measures keep spreading. A judge yesterday issued a preliminary injunction to block enforcement of South Dakota's new riot-boosting law, which passed earlier this year to deter pipeline protests. The law threatens heavy penalties for any person or group that encourages a quote-unquote riot, which is defined broadly enough to include any forms of public protest. What does this mean going forward, particularly for those that are trying to prevent pipelines being built across public as well as protected and Native American lands? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a talk show host from the Fallon Forum. He's director of Bold Iowa and a former lawmaker, Ed Fallon. Ed, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hey, how you doing, Wilmer?
I'm doing well, and thanks for joining me. So talk a bit, first of all, about how big of an issue is this as people, in, particularly in the Midwest, are trying to prevent the building of some of these pipelines across their lands?
Yeah, of course. There's still funding of the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska and in the Dakotas. In Iowa, we fought a long time against the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's the same pipeline that runs through Standing Rock, through South Dakota, also through Illinois. And we lost that fight. They started running oil through that pipeline back in June of 2017. But now the company wants to double the amount of oil flowing through there. They were allowed to flow 570,000 barrels a day, which is huge. That's the same as 30 coal-fired power plants. That's terrible. But they want to double it. They want to increase it, and mostly for export. And so, because there was such a strong pushback, not just in Iowa, in North Dakota, South Dakota, but across the country, because of such a strong pushback against these projects, the opposition, the oil industry, they've gotten desperate, and they've gone to great measures to try to make sure that even First Amendment protected free speech is not going to be allowed. They did have a bill here in Iowa, and even though they had a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, we were able to basically force them to pass a very restrictive piece of legislation that didn't go anywhere near as far as they want to go in South Dakota and some other places.
U.S. District Judge Lawrence Pearsall granted the injunction in response to a motion filed by the ACLU, which is representing four organizations and two indigenous individuals in a suit alleging that the law is unconstitutional for troubling vagueness and a chilling effect on speech. The Sierra Club, one of the organizations challenging the law, said that it would make the group hesitant to challenge the Keystone XL pipeline through protected forms of speech like rallies and online campaigns due to the risk of costly fines, up to three times the cost of any damages incurred by a related protest. This really, I think, demonstrates the power of lobbyists on judicial and legislative processes. Talk a little bit about what you all have gone through and are going through in Iowa.
Well, right now the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline here was largely a coalition of landowners, farmers, environmentalists, and Native people. And a lot of it focused on the abuse of eminent domain, the coming in to take land, the destruction of our soil, because we have this amazing soil here. And when you turn it in the wet conditions and mix the topsoil with the subsoil, you get all these problems that just basically ruin your soil. So we had there was a strong coalition of people across the political spectrum who came together to oppose it. And the pipeline company, these are some of the wealthiest people in the world. They didn't see it coming. And they wanted to start blowing that oil in, I think, September of 2016. We slowed them down a lot. They didn't even get it going until mid 2017. And so, they came back to try to find ways of making sure that we could never get in their way again. And they had a bill that did two things. It would define a pipeline as critical infrastructure, which is absurd because when you think about what is really critical infrastructure, you think about a road, a sewer line, a school, a hospital, power lines. You don't think about a pipeline that's merely transporting oil from up north to the Gulf of Mexico for export to China. That's not critical infrastructure. That's only there to help somebody make a heck of a lot of money. And so we fought them on that account. We fought the definition of critical infrastructure. And the other component that we fought was they wanted to make severe penalties for impeding any work on a critical infrastructure pipeline. And so on that piece, we were able to work with the same unions that were opposed to us, because there were unions like the Operators Union that were led to believe that there would be a lot of jobs with this pipeline. And so they signed on to support the pipeline back in 2014. And even though there was just a couple unions that really wanted it, the Operators Union, the pipeline fitters, the builders, they were able to get the entire Federation of Labor in Iowa to stand with them. So we had this very uncomfortable situation where labor was on the side of big oil, which was just ugly, and we were
Let me ask you this real quick. Do you have any general idea how many jobs were promised, how many jobs were realized?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you about that because, again, they've never released actual numbers, but there had to be between 50 and 100 times when our people, landowners, who knows what, different people went to the pipeline construction sites. We went there and we counted the cars and we looked at the license plates. And that's a pretty good indication of where people are from, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, one out of every 10 of those license plates were from Iowa. So basically, the unions got duped. They got fooled. They got fooled into believing this was really going to be a jobs program for them. But what happened, once the company decided to try to push this legislation that would criminalize protests, labor unions realized that it wasn't just about criminalizing pipeline protests. It was also going to affect their ability to strike, their ability to organize, their ability to do a walkout.
Okay.
And so those of us who are on opposite sides of the original pipeline fight, the unions versus the farmers, the landowners, the environmentalists, the native people, we all came together and said, this is a bad bill. this bill
okay.
must not pass.
Okay.
And the problem was Republicans were in charge of the House and Senate and the governor's office in Iowa, and they all kind of wanted it. I mean, there were enough Democrats that wanted it too, but once labor started pushing, you know, that peeled off a lot of the Democratic support. And then there were some Republicans who didn't like it because of issues of eminent domain and property rights. And so in the end, they did pass a bill that defined the pipeline as, quote, critical infrastructure, but they never really were able to get the type of anti-protest law passed that they wanted to. So we saw a bit of a victory on that here.
Okay.
That's not the case everywhere.
Right.
Like in South Dakota. So that's why we're really fortunate to have the courts come in.
You mentioned other places. In addition to the 9 states that have already passed such a law, statutes criminalizing oil and gas protests specifically are also pending in Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Texas and Georgia recently passed laws that create new penalties for protesters on college campuses. And it's interesting, in his statement granting the preliminary injunction against the South Dakota law, Judge Pearsall suggested that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference could have been liable had a riot-boosting law existed during their protests in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, you mentioned that 570,000 barrels per day are flowing through the pipeline, and if they want to double that, one of the big issues with these types of pipelines are accidents. Do you have any indication or any data about have there been accidents and what impact is this having on the land?
Well, I'll give you one example. Shortly after the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposedly finished, there was a spill in South Dakota. Again, I can't remember the details in terms of where it was, mm-hmm. and it wasn't huge, but there was a spill in South Dakota. And we have said all along that it's not a question of whether or not this pipeline is going to break in Iowa. It's going to break. It's just a question of when and where. It's going to happen. And if they increase the flow of oil like they want to do, it's just going to create more pressure, more heat, and more volume. So when it does break, you're going to have that much more oil pouring into our water or our fields. There's an example, I think it was in North Dakota, Farmer Johnson, I forget Johnson's first name, but he was out on his tractor one day and he's tooling along there and suddenly he starts sinking into the ground and he realizes he's sinking into dirt saturated with oil. And I can't remember which pipeline this was, but the pipeline going through his property had broke and the pipeline company's detection system failed. They didn't know about it. It was him, the farmer, discovered it. And once he found it and reported it and they started assessing the damage and started to try to clean it up, they're looking at multiple millions of dollars for cleanup. And in the end, there's no saving that farm. That farm is ruined.
That was my next question. Even after you come in and so-called clean up, can you actually clean up a spill of that nature?
Not thoroughly. You can remediate the damage, but it's a big deal. We had a train spill last year in Iowa, northwest Iowa, not too far from the South Dakota line, in fact. The train spilled and dumped, I can't remember how many cars tipped over and dumped their oil into the Little Rock River up there. It was tar sands oil from Alberta, which is some of the worst, toxic, heaviest oil.
That was my next question.
Yeah, it's bad stuff. I mean, no oil is anything you'd want to serve for breakfast or take a bath in. It's all bad stuff, you know. Really, we just ought to be leaving it in the ground at this point. But some is worse than others, and there's some oil that when it gets into your system, your water system, your land, it's just there's no way to really clean it up without having some long-term damage.
Now, as I understand it, this tar sands oil is of such a nature that there's only one refinery, I believe in Texas, that can refine this tar sands oil, and it's owned by the Koch brothers that own the refinery in Texas, and that this is the only refinery that can process or refine this tar sands oil. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
See, the oil flowing to Iowa is not tar sands oil.
Got you.
It's called Bakken oil. It's from North Dakota, and again, it's not nice stuff either. But it's not the total villain of oil, which is what Alberta tar sands oil is.
And where is the North Dakota oil that's flowing through the pipeline through Iowa? Where is that oil going to be refined?
Well, it goes to a hub in Patoka, Illinois. That's about halfway down the state. And there it connects with another pipeline and flows on down to, I believe, Netherlands, Texas. And it's refined there. But here's the big kicker, Wilmer. Back when Dakota Access was pushing to have this pipeline built, they were also pushing Congress to lift a 40-year ban on exporting crude oil. It used to be that you could only export processed crude. In other words, you could only export gasoline. You couldn't export the raw product. But while they were building this pipeline, which was supposed to be for domestic consumption, right, they also went ahead, Congress changed the law, so they could export crude oil. So now this oil coming through Iowa, and probably tar sands oil as well, through Keystone, is destined to go to the Gulf of Mexico, not because they're going to refine it and send it back to the U.S. Yes, some of it will come back in the form of, you know, fuel for our cars, but a lot of it's going to China, because China is very gradually shifting from coal to oil and gas, and that's a lateral move. That's not going to help the climate any. And the other problem is, of course, is that this company, they are investing. Energy Transfer Pipeline, Energy Transfer Corporation, I guess it's called now, is the umbrella company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline. Guess what they did earlier this year? They opened an office in Beijing. So they know they've got a big market in China, and they know that because of the law change, they're going to be able to export stuff from the U.S. to China.
So do you have a sense of this recent drone attack that hit the Saudi refining plant? Does that provide a rationale or a justification for the exportation of crude oil that for 40 years had been banned? I'm not saying that that was the reason it was done, but I'm saying that now that that has happened, that's an advantage to American oil exporters that previously did not exist.
Sure, taking out the competition with an occasional drone strike, that's not a bad idea. I mean, I'm being sarcastic, but yeah, I mean, anything that hurts foreign sources increases the opportunity for big companies here to make more money. And I'll say this, you know, we have a lot of presidential candidates in Iowa. Actually, there's so far this month, there's already 150 candidate events scheduled. On Saturday, we'll be seeing 18 of them here in Des Moines. So we get to know a lot about these people. And one thing I'll tell you about Beto O'Rourke, who I like on many levels, but Beto O'Rourke, he voted for lifting that ban on crude oil exports. There weren't too many Democrats who supported that. He did. We have a problem with that. We also have a problem with Joe Biden, who said back here in May, on May 1st, he said he was proud of the fact that the U.S. had become the biggest producer of energy in the world. What that means is we're now the biggest producer of oil and gas. We're now the biggest culprit when it comes to extracting oil and gas from the ground. And pretty soon, in the very near future, the way we're going, we're going to be the biggest exporter as well as the biggest producer. And again, that's just so wrong in terms of the impact on our land, our water, our property rights here, and even more important, on climate. We cannot continue to see this kind of exploitation of toxic fossil fuel, you know, carbon producing, greenhouse gas producing products that are just clearly making our planet less habitable.
Ed Fallon, talk show host from the Fallon Forum and director of Bold Iowa, as well as a former lawmaker. Ed, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks, Wilmer.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.